This is Jim Inkster. Today on the show, we'll visit with Diane Francis, a Canadian journalist. She has proposed a compelling concept that is a HarperCollins book, Merger of the Century. Diane Francis, featured often in the Huffington Post and a dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada, born in Chicago, is proposing that Canada and the United States become one, as in one country. Also, Dr. E. Fay Williams, the veteran activist from Louisiana, on the life and legacy of T.J. Jemison, who died 2 weeks ago at the age of 95. Reverend Jemison was the pastor of the Mount Zion First Baptist Church in Baton Rouge for 54 years. And author Carolyn Recapito. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving and glad you're spending Black Friday with us. Our leadoff guest is Diane Francis, a Canadian journalist and the editor of the Financial Post. She's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, a broadcaster, author of 9 books on Canadian socioeconomic subjects, and her latest work is certainly a tantalizing concept, Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. Good morning, Diane Francis.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, you were born in Chicago, correct?
Yes. I'm a dual citizen. I work, vote, pay taxes, and live in both countries.
So, why should Canada and the U.S. come together?
Well, I think there's one main underlying existential issue that I dealt with in this book, which is the germ of the idea, which was started 4 years ago as a project. Canada has the second biggest piece of real estate in the world. It's the second largest country, slightly larger than the United States. It has a very relatively small population, about a tenth of the United States, 35 million, clustered along the southern border for the most part. And it has too small an economy to develop the hinterland, which is full of the greatest resource endowment left in the world. And it's also too small to defend it. And the Chinese have targeted its resources. They're trying to buy into our companies with some difficulties at times, but not with others. And the Russians have declared the Arctic as Russian. So I just pulled back as a dual citizen who admires both countries. I don't think one country is better than the other. And said, Canada needs a partner to develop and defend itself going forward. The world is going to get even hungrier for resources that it has. And its partner is already the United States. And yes, I know there's history, but, you know, people can overcome. And I think there is a convergence of sorts. I think the two countries are more similar than they've ever been in history. And they're both sort of multicultural and that sort of thing. And they have the same value. So I said, I think they should merge. Let's look at how they'd go about it. So the book then gets into a menu of ways to merge, from just a joint venture to develop the North, or have some kind of big agreements on treaty, on energy, environment, and customs and immigration and all of that, to a European Union type thing where you create a higher level of government, two countries stay the same, to just a full-on German-style merger.
297-5633, Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country, from Diane Francis, a native of Chicago, who has dual citizenship, Canada and the United States. As you noted, Canada has 35 million people, the United States well over 300 million people. In fact, California has 4 million more residents than does the country of Canada. So would Canada get the short end of the stick here?
Well, no. When I do my thought experiment and I go into my different merger models, the German full-on merger is the most fun, actually, to read. I worked with an investment banker, and I said, let's look at two countries that are different in size, different in economic size as well as population. Pretend they're companies. How would we merge these two guys so that everybody won? And so we did a merger model where Canadians would get roughly 13 states, and to add to the U.S. mix, and they would also have to be compensated for, in some way, their over contribution of extra resources. And so I broke that down into dollars, hypothetical, all hypothetical, and said this would be the basis to begin some kind of negotiation for accession. That would be the fast and easiest way. It basically is what East and West Germany did. It's the same model. And then I looked at things like a European Union, where you create a higher level, like a binational government commission that overlooks continental matters, and the two countries stay intact. And that would also involve getting rid of the border altogether. You can't get rid of the border with Mexico at this point, and I don't think they're mature enough to join this idea, but I think it makes all kinds of sense. You know, the European countries are very distinctive. They have their own legal and health care systems, and yet they have no border, and that works very well for them economically.
So Canada gets 13 states. That makes it a 63-state country. Their political ramifications of this, which major party would be benefited the most from this?
Well, in this book, because I'm not naive, I have a whole chapter on some of the polling that would lead me to, you know, lead the reader to draw some conclusions about how doable this is from a political point of view. Canada has the same kind of polarization and fragmentation politically as the United States. So thinking about this happening in the near future is probably foolish, and there are huge numbers of impediments. I would say that one of the interesting realities is that if there were a full-on German-style merger, there'd be 35 million Democrats coming into the U.S. And so I jokingly say to some of the Republicans who really like this idea from a national security and an economic opportunity and a jobs point of view that, you know, you guys would never get the White House again. But I bounced this idea off Jeb Bush recently, and he said, "Oh yes, we would. When we get the right leader, we'll win, and everybody will realize Republican is the best way." So, the leanings of Canadians, of course, are not uniform, but Canada has the same sort of, I would say, political and social culture as New England or the Pacific Northwest. And in fact, those regions of the United States, including Minnesota, Wisconsin, have more liberal laws, actually, and lower crime rates than Canada, and they're roughly the same population. So, you know, America's regionalized, and of course, I'm talking to you in Baton Rouge. I don't have to tell you about Quebec. That is a whole other story, just like Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the black population of Canada?
I don't know. It's been principally a British colony until 31, and I would say until about 78, 79, the immigration flow was mostly from the British Isles, and then it opened up to the rest of the Commonwealth. So it reflects that. It's African, it's Middle Eastern, it's South Asian, it's Chinese. I don't know what the mix, but in Toronto, it's 50% of the people in Toronto, and that's about 3 million people, were not even born in Canada. So it has a very high immigrant population. 1 in 5 Canadians was born outside the country. In the United States, it's 1 in 8.
The United States would become wider, but you say more democratic, and my guess is that the politics...
Capital D, democratic.
Politics are such that it would be very difficult to get this through. But what would be the first step?
Well, the first step is kind of what they've been haltingly trying to do, and they call it the security perimeter. The security perimeter means that you actually do more or less erase the border between the countries for workers to move. And you have to do that. It's very complicated because it's the first step the Europeans took. You have to blend your immigration, your customs, your tax, your policing, your homeland security. All that has to be blended. And, you know, that's tricky. And so, but the Europeans have done it with no problem. And the other important thing is that Canada's hinterland is going to be developed, probably a lot with American money, whether this happens or not, because of the amount of American investment already in Canada. But millions of jobs are going to open up in mines and oil fields and building infrastructure throughout Canada. And those are jobs that, in my estimation, should be open to Americans first and foremost. They should have first right of refusal, as opposed to bringing in immigrants from lesser developed countries that do not have the skill sets. And that's what Canada's been doing. Now we're changing our immigration laws. But right now, there should be a fast-track immigration between the United States and Canada, minimally. And so that's the step. That's going to take a couple of years, and it was announced 2 years ago, and nothing has happened.
297-5633 for Diane Francis. Her book is Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country, from HarperCollins. Diane has dual citizenship. How does it work with you being a citizen of both countries? You say you pay taxes in both the U.S. and in Canada?
You don't pay twice as much tax, but you pay more tax. And what you do is you file taxes. I live in Canada principally. That's where my income mostly is. So I file taxes to the Canadian authorities, and I usually pay higher taxes than I would have in the U.S., but I file the same tax form with the Americans, and they will determine whether I owe them a little extra. And then I always have to pay a minimum tax of about $1,800, even if I don't owe any taxes. And then, of course, I have the cost of filing two sets of tax returns. So bottom line is you actually pay whoever, you have the same income, but you pay the higher of either tax rate, and Canada's tax rate's higher than in the United States because our health care system is completely paid for out of taxes. So, you know, we pay, you know, 5% more in taxation, but our Medicare is covers everything.
That's a question that comes from Shannon. How would health care be handled with Canada having a nationalized health plan for many years?
Well, these are the very tricky things that the Europeans have learned how to finesse around. I mean, the healthcare systems in Europe are a patchwork quilt. So are the laws. And so, you know, to a certain extent, you have that in the U.S. and in Canada. Canada has more uniform laws. The federal government imposes a criminal code. In the United States, criminal law varies from state to state. So does punishment. And so, you know, it works. You have to have extradition. You have to understand how to do it. With the healthcare system, I think Canadians wouldn't even consider doing anything along a merger line until the United States provides basic health care at a reasonable cost to all of its citizens, which you're taking the first step to trying to do.
Prescription drugs cost much less in Canada than they do in the U.S. I would imagine pharmaceutical companies would not like this.
Well, the pharmaceutical companies are making a fortune. You see, what happens is that they charge American consumers more than they charge consumers all over the world, and I'll tell you why. They give volume discounts, which is good business, and it doesn't mean they're not profitable. So if I'm selling, you know, whatever it is, Lipitor, and I'm selling it to the Ontario health system that insures 11 million people, although we pay for drugs unless we're on, you know, disability or something, or we're elderly. But if I'm selling it to that system where they're insuring 12 million people or 11 million people all at once, I'm going to give a deep discount to that. They do the same in Japan. They do the same in Germany. They do the same in France. The American consumer pays more for American drugs. So volume discounts were illegal in the United States. The state of Illinois attacked that 10 years ago, and I think that's getting fixed now. But, you know, that's actually not very nice to have done, to play Americans off against the rest of the world and give everybody else a bargain.
What do we call the country?
Well, what do you think? I didn't further a guess. I think it always stays Canada and the United States, and maybe you call it the United States or the North American Union or something like that if you do it. There's been a lot of funny names. One of the cutest was USAEH, making fun of our punctuation at the end of our sentences in Canada. The other thing that's very interesting to speculate about, and I do, is if this ever happened where the border disappeared, there's 3 million Canadians living in the United States now. That's almost 10% of the population. That would jump hugely. And everybody who's a snowbird in Florida that stays 4 months a year will stay 12 months a year, and people will go down to Baton Rouge and buy your houses because it's a nice climate.
All right, well, Canada with 35 million people, the U.S. with about 320 million people or so. There's obviously a big disparity, and one-tenth or so of the population in Canada. But Diane Francis is offering a proposal in which Canada would get about one-quarter as many states as there are in the United States.
Because it's the biggest, richest piece of real estate on the planet.
We'll talk more. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with author Diane Francis. Her book from HarperCollins is Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. Diane Francis lives in Canada most of the time, but has dual citizenship and is a native of Chicago. In which city do you live?
I live in Toronto.
Okay.
And, you know, Jim, I really appreciate this because the whole reason I wrote the book, this is a long-term look at public policy options for both of these countries. The other issue is that state capitalism, as practiced by China, Russia, and others, is bearing down on our free enterprise system, and we've got to get our acts together and look at the world in a different way to compete and to continue to prosper. And I'm just trying to set up conversations in both countries, and it's working, and I really appreciate it. And on an ongoing basis, people like you with big audiences continue the conversation.
So is the new capital, is it going to be in Ottawa or in Washington, D.C., or someplace in between, maybe Detroit? Where do we have the nation's capital now if we merge?
Well, if you do a German full-on merger, they move the capital from Bonn, which was there, was not their traditional capital, but it was there because of the communist Iron Curtain, to Berlin. And but they kept some offices in Bonn. You got to understand, Ottawa is the second coldest capital in the world, and it's colder than Moscow. The coldest is Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, for goodness sake. So I don't think there'd be a lot of tears if the civil servants in Ottawa had to move to Washington, D.C.
297-5633. We'll spend a few more minutes with Diane Francis, an interesting lady, regular contributor to the Huffington Post, who is proposing that Canada and the United States become one country. Merger of the Century is Diane's book. You've been around for a while. It took you a while to offer this to the masses. What took so long?
Well, I've been, you know...
Whoops, go ahead.
...in Canada for a number of years, and I'm principally a business writer, and I travel all over. I've covered events all over the world, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to, you know, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. And so I've been busy. This one is a very personal book, because I went on a show recently, Fareed Zakaria, it hasn't aired yet, and he said, you want a merger because you are the merger. And so I just see these two countries. I've dedicated the book to both countries. I love both countries, and I think they both are different, but they're unique, and they're equally wonderful. And I just think this makes good sense, and I think it could help the countries cope with the external challenges they face, as well as optimize what they have already. And, you know, Americans need more jobs. Canadians have a small population, need workers. I think it could be a marriage made in heaven.
Nicholas on Nicholson. Hi, Nicholas. You're on with Diane Francis.
Hi, good morning. I travel to Canada quite often, and I think your suggestion is very far-fetched. I am pretty sure that right now, if you ran a referendum, the majority of Canadians would be against the merger. They are very patriotic, they are very nationalistic, and those that I know, the Canadians that I know, would not even think about the merger. I think your idea is very far-fetched.
I think your perception is interesting, and the point is that, you know, a full-on merger is one of many, many options available, and if it isn't acceptable, then it doesn't happen. It's as simple as that. It took many, many years for the European Union to get to where they are, and, you know, the point is that it may take that long a time. There was a recent kind of poll in Toronto, and it was about, you know, would you join the U.S. if you got compensation for resources from Canada and that sort of thing. And that zoomed up to about 42% yes. Now, that's just a very, unstructured poll, unscientific. The only Gallup poll I came across in my research was in 1964, 48% of Canadians said yes, they would merge with the United States. More recently, a poll that was done by the Woodrow Wilson Institute and the University of Western Ontario showed that 65 to 70% of Canadians would say, yes, let's get rid of the border, not necessarily politically merge, but let's get rid of the border as long as it improves our quality of life. So there is an appetite for more integration. Is there an appetite for political integration? That's another step.
Bart in Denham Springs. Hi, Bart. You're on the air with Diane Francis.
Hi. Your guest just kind of gave me a good segue into my comment. She's talking about the probably not favorable for political integration. Honestly, I can't imagine the Canadians being willing to merge with the U.S. Because of the incompetence and the corruption that we've seen in our government in the last, say, decade.
Well, that's an interesting comment, but, you know, we don't really, I mean, I live and work in both countries, and I observe both countries as a journalist. I did a piece recently in the New York Post. In fact, you can Google Diane Francis, Rob Ford. We have a mayor in Toronto that's out of control. I mean, he makes Charlie Sheen look like he's normal. But also in there, I said in the article that Rob Ford is not an anomaly in Canada. And I go through the list of corruption, and it is pretty breathtaking. We've had 8 mayors in the last couple of years that have either been pushed out or are criminally charged with theft. We have 4 senators out of 105 senators that are being investigated by police for, you know, possibly stealing money, a couple that have been charged. We have, you know, we have a provincial government in Ontario that is being investigated by police for canceling 2 gas plants, costing taxpayers $1 billion. We have a lot of scandals, too. So, you know, that's one of the things that I hope that people read this book, they understand. Different than they thought it was, and Canadians are also understanding that America is a little different than they think it is. And 3 million Canadians live in America, so they like it just fine.
Michael on Segan. Good morning, Michael. You're on with Diane Francis. Michael, are you there?
Business industry there. I understand that Canada's banking industry is a bit more regulated than it is here. So how do you think the Canadian banks and markets would react to merging with sort of our laissez-faire style markets here in America?
Well, since the meltdown, that's a great question. Since the meltdown, the Dodd-Frank sets of regulations that the administration and Congress have imposed on American banks almost copies what we have in Canada, which is why in Canada we never had a bank go bankrupt or an insurance company in the Great Depression or the Great Recession. And so I think the regulations now are more sensible in the U.S. And what's interesting is that the big 5 Canadian banks who have been protected from foreign competition and also protected from themselves with regulation, have now become 5 of the biggest, of the 10 biggest in the world. So they would be just fine in a merger, and they're already expanding very rapidly into the United States. And so I don't think that that's as much of an issue. Got to remember, we did free trade in 87. Mexico came in later, and in 87 there was the same kind of debate, oh my gosh, we'll be gobbled up and swallowed and eaten alive by the Americans. It didn't happen, and free trade demonstrably has been better for the 2 countries. I'm just saying we should do what all other free trade countries do and get rid of the border altogether.
Arn on Jones Creek, you're on the air with Diane Francis, author of Merger of the Century. Good morning. Good morning.
Hello. Okay. Yeah, I didn't got static there. No, I just 2 comments. One, I think it's somewhat of a good idea, but I think the Canadians are too smart to do it, and the Americans too stupid. But I do think a confederation or maybe expansion of NAFTA could be something that would work out.
Well, I don't think NAFTA is a good idea. I think that the Mexico. U.S. relationship, Mexico-Canadian relationship. Mexico has a lot of problems. We know that. It's a very nice country, but you could never open the border up with Mexico, not for many years. They have weak institutions, corruption, the drug trade, and their wages are 1/3 of Canadian-American wages. And, you know, that's a formula for disaster if you open up the border. So that may come along. I'm talking about going further with the 2 countries that are more integrated already than any other 2 countries in the world. and realizing some benefits from it economically and otherwise. I mean, for Canadians, we live in a cold country. Canadians would love, many more Canadians, and immigration is difficult. Many more Canadians would love to take opportunities in the United States for climate reasons and economic reasons. And you're living in an area of oil, of the oil industry in Louisiana. You know, there could be a lot of great jobs in Canada for Louisiana oil workers and people with those skills than there is available now because the immigration thing is so difficult. So I see a lot of wonderful cross-pollination in taking the thing a little further.
Well, we thank
step by step.
We thank you for joining us, Diane Francis. The book is Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country, and we will follow this discussion with you. Thank you, Diane.
Great. Thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Take care.
Bye-bye.
297-5633, your number outside our area. It is 877-217-5757. The Reverend T.J. Jemison, civil rights pioneer who organized the 1953 bus boycott in Baton Rouge. He was pastor of the Mount Zion First Baptist Church in Baton Rouge for 54 years. He died 2 weeks ago today, and his death has been mentioned in many places, including some segments on National Public Radio, and we are talking a bit about him before the month is out, appropriately, a gentleman who spent most of his life right here in our midst. And with us to discuss the life and legacy of T.J. Jemison is Faye Williams. Good morning, Faye. Faye Williams. All right. See if we can get Faye on the line. I don't know if we're having phone issues or if she has, at least for the moment, disappeared, but we'll get Faye back. But T.J. Jemison died November 15th. He was 95 years old. Theodore Judson Jemison, he was born in Selma, Alabama, August 1st, 1918, youngest of six children, came to Baton Rouge, and in 1953, when he was 35 years old, he led the boycott that became the model for other boycotts, including the more famous one in Montgomery. He was president of the National Baptist Convention USA from 1982 to 1994, and he ushered into being the World Baptist Center in Nashville, the first national headquarters of a predominantly black church in the United States. He was known for his political skills in the early days of the civil rights struggle. He displayed a mix of charm and toughness that served him in leading what historians say was apparently the movement's first large-scale bus boycott. T.J. Jemison was a man who was recognized around the country and even internationally for his work. And Faye Williams, who is a person who has also been recognized for her work, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women and former counsel to the U.S. Congress's District of Columbia Subcommittee on the Judiciary and Education. She ran for Congress in Louisiana a few times, came within a whisker of beating Clyde Holloway in 1986, and she is still active in politics in a big way in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Faye.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. I'm sure it's cold in the nation's capital today.
Yeah, but it doesn't keep thousands of people from being out today to picket for dignity for, you know, workers all across the country and all across the world who are getting less than a minimum wage. And as you know, that's a big issue here. And I think it's the kind of issue that Dr. Jemison would have been involved in had he been with us today.
How well did you know him?
Well, I knew him very well. You know, I didn't know him very well before I ran for the U.S. Congress, but, of course, I was just delighted to meet him during that campaign. I'd heard of him before. When I went to run for the office of United States Congress, everybody told me, you have to go and see Dr. Jemison. You have to go and see Dr. Jemison. And, of course, that proved to be a good decision because from the very first time I met him, he reached out to help me and not just give me talk. Like, you know, many of the other politicians were afraid to commit to me. Dr. Jemison was never afraid. He would invite me to his churches, would ask other ministers to invite me to their churches. He would help me raise money. Just whatever I needed, gave me advice, and I'm just appreciative to him and don't want him to ever be forgotten.
Well, the year-long Montgomery bus boycott a few years after the Baton Rouge bus boycott, set off by Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her seat to a white person, began the end of the separate but equal accommodations in the South. And Dr. Martin Luther King in 1958 says, knowing that Jemison and his associates had set up an effective private carpool, I put in a long-distance telephone call to ask him for suggestions for a similar pool in Montgomery. So that's how it all began.
And isn't that amazing that we hear so much about Dr. King, but not about Dr. Jemison? I mean, I know a lot of people, particularly church people, Baptist people, know about Dr. Jemison, but not as well as they know about Dr. King. And yet, Dr. Jemison was one who set that pattern. So if we don't tell our story, it's so easy for people to forget. And that's why I'm so appreciative of you to do this little segment so that we can remember Dr. T.J. Jemison.
Well, he was a man who had critics and more admirers than critics, but it kind of goes with the territory when you're out front that you're going to make decisions that occasionally are controversial. On the whole, though, what is his contribution? 54 years at Mount Zion Baptist Church here in Baton Rouge and several decades as the leader of the nation's largest Black Baptist group.
Well, I think one of the things we get from Dr. Jemison's life is that it doesn't matter who you are. You can make a difference if you will only try. You can help other people gain dignity and respect if you're willing to stand up. And, you know, also he taught us that silence gives our consent to various things. So when we don't like something that's going on in our world, we can't depend upon others to do it. We ourselves need to stand up, even if we're the first one to walk out there and give someone advice or to show people that we're not afraid to make a difference in the lives of those who need us. Because sometimes people cannot speak for themselves. So those of us who can, then we need to do that. And that's what people all across the country are doing today. We need not forget him, because there are other young people coming behind us who need to understand that Dr. Jemison was fearless. I mean, sure, he lived well, but it was because he stood up for people who could not stand up for themselves throughout his life.
In Tuesday's New York Times, there was a remarkable obit for Dr. Jemison. It reads, in 1953, he persuaded the Baton Rouge City Council to abolish a public transportation rule barring blacks from sitting in the first 10 rows of public buses. When bus drivers went on strike to protest the change, Mr. Jemison led an 8-day boycott starting on June 20th. Blacks accounted for 80% of the city's bus ridership, and they were tired of having to stand up while some or even all of the first 10 rows went empty. That was the cause for this boycott, and Jemison said, "We were not necessarily interested at that time in ending segregation. We were after seats." So if this act had not happened in 1953 in Baton Rouge, I think it's fair to say that a lot of things that happened on a positive realm would have been delayed in other parts of the United States and around the country as a whole.
You're absolutely right, especially in Montgomery, Alabama. But, you know, you can take that even further. Kip Holden would probably not be mayor of Baton Rouge. President Barack Obama probably would not be our president, or Michelle, our first lady. So many things would not be happening today but for the pace that Dr. Jemison set.
And we'll be back with Faye Williams in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And we're spending a few more minutes with Dr. E. Faye Williams, formerly of Alexandria. That's her hometown. And she ran for Congress, as we know, a few times in Louisiana and lost in one of the closest races on record to Clyde Holloway in 1986. Since then, she has been quite active, primarily in Washington, D.C., national chair of the National Congress of Black Women, and Faye has degrees from Howard University, her law degree, a master's in public administration from USC, and her B.S. degree is from Grambling. We're talking about the life and legacy of T.J. Jemison. What would Reverend Jemison think of the boycott the Grambling football players put on earlier this year? Would he approve?
Well, I think he would, because first of all, the young people were standing up for someone that they knew and that they loved, and a program they know and love, and they were risking a lot just as Dr. Jemison was over 50 years ago, because many of them could have lost their scholarships, but they were willing to give up that to gain something, to gain self-respect, and to gain support for the person they knew and loved. So I think Dr. Jemison would have approved of it.
Well, you have written about him glowingly, and you say you really didn't get to know him until you ran for Congress. And
right.
There has been a discussion through the years about the blending of religion and politics, Faye. When is it appropriate for people who are leaders of congregations to get immersed in the political scene?
Well, if churches or religious people cannot help those who are in need, then I'm not sure they would be following the edicts of the person that they or the Christ or the God that they say they worship. I mean, what good would religion be if we could not be involved where help is most needed? I think the church is very political, and rightly so. It doesn't matter what the law said. Laws have been wrong before, and yet people took their chance and did what they thought was right to make it to make everything okay. We're talking about civil rights now. Many people stood up for civil rights. Many of them lost their jobs, but it was the church who came to their rescue, and rightly so. You know, they helped them with payment of their bills or taking care of their families until they could get on their feet. There are some people still with us today who were civil rights workers, and they're just barely making a living. But usually they can turn to the church for the help that they need, and I think that's right. It is the law, I believe, that is wrong or that needs some adjustment, but I don't think there's a way to keep church people from doing God's work.
Well, this is something that cuts both ways. For example, in this community, there are some fundamentalist churches, mostly all white, who a couple of years ago, last year, you had ministers in the pulpit calling for the election of Mitt Romney, and yet you had black churches where the pastor from the pulpit was calling the election of Barack Obama. Is that okay?
Well, as long as a person in the church does not try to force you to select their choice, I think it's okay for them to give their opinion, and I think they rightly give their opinion. As you know, I have a degree in the ministry, and I have no problem discussing it, though I don't have a church, but I have no problem discussing with people what I believe. Right now, we need church people. We need everybody discussing the real issues of what's happening with the poor, with the indigent people, because we have so many people who call themselves Christians or, you know, leaders in the church who are doing such mean-spirited things to the people who need it most. So I think it's right for the church to be involved in all kinds of ways in the lives of people to help to make their lives better. The church has no problem getting involved in the lives of women when these decisions ought to be made by women and their doctors. So why wouldn't they be involved in other areas of life, you know, to advise, to do, or to not do? I think the church has a role in the total community, and I'm not afraid to have a minister stand up and give me the facts of life as he or she knows them. And then it's up to me to make my decision.
Perhaps one of the most compelling messages we should take from Dr. Jemison's life is that people should be involved.
Yes.
And unfortunately, despite the fact that we have ministers and others who encourage people to vote, and maybe on occasion to vote in a certain way, we still don't have great turnouts for elections. The only time we really get a big turnout is when we have a presidential election or a gubernatorial election, and even then, quite often half the people stay home.
Well, it just shows that all of us have a lot more work to do, and we have to continue to tell people about the lives of Dr. Jemison, Dr. King, Rosa Parks, and others who died to actually help us gain these rights. I think when people are getting jobs, when they see the church helping to and other organizations helping to find those jobs from and kind of putting down the evilness, the evil things, and the meanness of spirit that we're seeing on the part of so many now, then people will have a reason to come out. But when they don't see elections making a difference in their lives, it is harder to get them to come out to vote. So they're probably going to just vote on an emotional issue. And for many of us who in terms of the presidential election, that was an emotional issue for us, you know, whether we saw it as politically correct or what have you. It was an emotional one for us, and we who studied our history know how important that was to see someone like Barack Obama elected to be president of the United States. But we've got a lot of work to do to get people to be as interested, but then we've got to help to improve their lives so that they see the need to vote.
Paul Anopoulosis. Hello, Paul. You're on with Dr. Fay Williams.
How you doing, Dr. Williams? And happy belated Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Question. Dr. Jameson, who I didn't know personally but heard a lot of, when was the first time he met or had heard of Barack Obama? And what did he think of him early on? Thank you.
I'm sorry. The question was,
He asked if Dr. Jameson knew President Obama, and I'm not sure he did.
Well, he was very much up in age when President Obama came on the scene as a senator. So I would think that he knew about him, but I don't, because he too sent out a message regarding his work, but I don't think they were personal friends.
Well, and Dr. Jameson retired in 2003, and President Obama was elected to the U.S. Senate a year later. So I think Faye's right. He probably knew. I'm sure he knew of him, but I don't know that by that point he was not active publicly the way he had been for half a century. But he was a busy man for over 50 years, 54 years as the pastor of the Mount Zion First Baptist Church in Baton Rouge. Faye Williams.
And we're so grateful for that, Jim, and to you for having this segment on.
Well, thank you, and hope you have a great holiday weekend. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm sure it's cold in Washington, D.C. today.
Well, I'm going back to my picket line. Thank you.
Thank you. We're with Carolyn Sue Recapito, an author of Significance right here in our community. Her work is The Woman from Turnback County. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning.
Tell us about your book.
All right. My book is historical fiction. I was inspired to write this book by a page in a journal written in September of 1893 by my great-grandmother. She was an eyewitness to the Oklahoma land run of 1893. And I then began to research into her background. She began in Wales. The story begins in Wales. She travels as a young girl across the ocean to New York City with her sister. They're 12 and 14, and they then work as servants. Their ambition is to go west. They do end in Indian Territory, mm-hmm. which is later the state of Oklahoma. So it's a story of a girl growing into a woman, also an immigration story.
So they came to the United States in 1861.
1861, just as the Civil War begins. Well, they arrive in New York City. And this has an effect on their life, and this is the way I like to read history myself. I like to see it through the eyes of one person's experience, how the war affected these two girls, their lives. And my main character is named Dovey. She is a version of my great-grandmother. I found the name Dovey in a pioneer cemetery in Mounds, Oklahoma, and I liked it for mm-hmm. her, and I've used that name. She lived there, had a large family. Her children benefited and prospered from the oil boom of 1905 in Oklahoma, and this tells the story of how she got from Wales to Indian Territory.
They arrive in New York City. They're 12 and 14 in 1861,
yes.
Start of the Civil War and the start of the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. So
yes.
It was a time like no other in the United States. And that time is caught vividly in Oklahoma in The Woman from Turnback County. You grew up in Tulsa, didn't you?
I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My paternal family had come there in the 1890s, and my other mother's family in the early 1900s. So I lived among people who had experienced these things or known, or their parents had, and heard their stories all my life, really. So I was looking back into that. I got my sources by going around and interviewing the older members of the family, getting their stories. That's what interested me most. But I did a lot of research into census records, all of that sort of thing.
How long have you lived in Baton Rouge, Carolyn?
33 years now. So this is my home now.
I guess 1980. Carolyn Recapito, her book is Woman from Turnback County, and she is a person of immense talent, a poet and a writer of fiction, and her first novel is this one, but painting as well.
Painting, yes. I was very happy that an animal collage of mine won an honorable mention in the Animals in Art show this year. And I love that show at the vet school in at LSU, so I was very pleased to be in
that
it.
That was the Katrina dog?
Katrina dog, right. This is a dog that my daughter rescued after Katrina, and it has had a happy life in New York City now. So it went a long way from New Orleans.
Well, you have written for many years, and this is your first novel, and it's about an area of the country you know well, but you're of an age where, you might be writing your fourth or fifth novel.
That's true. I did start on that late. I, for many years, wrote poetry. Then, I was gradually drawn in by this journal page of my great-grandmother's. As I looked into their lives more, I found it very fascinating. So I visited most of the places. For instance, the council houses of Indians in Oklahoma are very full of history, and it's the history written in the words of the Indians rather than a white man's version of it, which you usually find in most books.
Well, Oklahoma is the home state of Woody Guthrie.
Yes, right.
Who was one of the great liberals of his time or any time, and yet the state of Oklahoma, every county went for Willard Mitt Romney last year in the presidential election.
That's true. I find that when I go home to reunions.
How did it become so conservative?
I think it may have to do with the independent spirit of the settlers. That's what I think. They made it, you know, made it through hardship. Their forebears made it through hardship, and they think, if I can do it, anyone can. So they have, seems to me to have very little feeling for those who are in need. Really.
Well, Carolyn not only is a fine writer, and her book, by the way, has received very nice reviews, The Woman from Turnback County, which is available in bookstores throughout the area. You occasionally write letters to the editor. I saw one the other day. You're not pleased with this $2 million center for Governor Foster's papers.
Why not? Well, I just feel that other governors have put their papers in the state archives, and this would save us $2 million as taxpayers for Governor Foster's papers to go there also.
Well, he wants it in Franklin, and Governor Jindal is all for it, and Treasurer Kennedy appears to be all for it, so quite possibly it's going to happen.
And it will come up soon, I guess.
Yeah, I was talking to Faye Williams about the Grambling boycott and the students there, the football players. They didn't get on the bus to Jackson, Mississippi earlier this year for a game against Jackson State. The Grambling budget for that university is under $13 million a year. So $2 million, think of what that could do to some of the repairs that are desperately needed at a place like Grambling. Is that more important or less important than a Center for Governor Foster's Papers in Franklin, Louisiana?
I really feel that following tradition of other governors, their papers have gone to the archives, which exists for this purpose, to keep state records for the future scholars, and I think his should go there as well.
Well, John Kennedy, the treasurer, said that all governors should have this opportunity. So I guess we would have a center for Buddy Romer in Bossier City, and one for Kathleen Blanco in Lafayette, one for Edwin Edwards in Crowley or Marksville. We could go on and on.
Can we really afford this, or should we put the money into education?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, a listener, Alan, notes that Governor Foster was actually born in Shreveport, so maybe that's where the papers should go.
Oh, or maybe have two. blow the bank on this one.
But you, of course, also have a very talented husband in Joseph Recapito. He's a writer, too.
He's a writer, too, and has a recent book, In Pursuit of Truth, an academic satire, which has just been published.
So what happens when you're both writing?
Well, we have separate rooms, but we do confer and then or read things. I give the other one papers to read, and what do you think? And, you know, we get opinions. We don't always take them, but we get opinions.
Well, you both do what you do very well and have been in this community for 33 years. And Carolyn Recapito's book, The Woman from Turnback County is available for those who'd like to pick up a copy, perhaps for the holidays, and we are pleased with your maiden voyage on this program.
Thank you.
And today, the LSU Fighting Tigers will be playing at home, 1:30 kickoff against the University of Arkansas. Tigers trying to finish the regular season 9-3, a bit of a disappointing season for Les Miles, but it could be worse. The Razorbacks, who 2 years ago came to Baton Rouge as a number three team in the country, this time come with an 11-game losing streak in the Southeastern Conference, 25-point underdogs. Should be a breeze for the LSU Tigers today at Death Valley. And tomorrow in the Superdome, same time kickoff, 1:30, it's Southern University. The Jaguars have had a good season. They play Grambling. Southern has done very well. Grambling is 1-10, and Southern has had a season that is significant. We'll talk about it Monday right here on this program. For J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Inkster. Hope you have a great holiday weekend, and until next time, keep listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.